Last class, we were discussing bound orbits on Kerr. And today, we're going to begin by considering a marginally bound orbit. That is, instead of having orbits where this energy is less than one, we're going to consider the case where it's equal to one. So you have a particle that would have zero velocity infinity. So, these are sometimes also called parabolic orbits, but that's kind of a Newtonian term. So, in Newtonian gravity, it is actually a parabola. You have some object that can come into infinity, come have a point of closest passage to some massive object, and then go back out. But actually, in GR, because we have precession, these orbits can look a lot more complicated. You have things that look like that, or even you have these zoom whirl type orbits, as you'll hopefully get to explore in the next tutorial, where you can kind of go around many times and then go back out. All right. So last time I wrote down this effective potential. That governs sort of the turning points of that orbit. And actually, that expression simplifies quite a lot when we just plug in that E tilde is equal to 1. So it takes the following form. So you remember that for the bound orbits case, the highest term is actually r to the 3, but that term is actually proportional to e tilde minus 1. So now we actually just have a quadratic term in brackets. And so that kind of makes our life easier in terms of determining the turning points where dr d tau is going to vanish. So we can just solve this quadratic to get those. Bless you. Okay, so that's just solving the quadratic. And you'll notice now that when we let r go to infinity, this term is gonna dominate, it's gonna be negative. So basically our potential can look like one of the following. So this is technically v times r to the third. So we can basically have no turning points when there's no real solutions to this, where this would be the horizon of the black hole. So if you were to start at infinity, you would just come all the way in, fall into the black hole. Or the other option is to have these, to have two roots, in which case, if you start at infinity, you would come in and then you would reach a turning point and then go back out. And of course there's a marginal case in between here where these two roots would merge and this point would just touch v equals zero. So we can determine that just by figuring out when this discriminant is equal to zero. Oops. Get away from me. Okay. So that occurs when, so I'm going to use M for marginal here. This, so again, we have some quadratic we want to solve. Now for the angular momentum. And we get the following. Oops. And then we can plug this back into our expression and figure out the turning points. So this will be basically the minimum radius that you can go close to the black hole and not fall all the way in on a parabolic orbit. So this is the general expression for different values of the dimension of the spin for this point of closest approach. And if you have something smaller than this, then you'll just fall back into the black hole. So we can look at this for a couple different values of the spin. So if we have extremal spin that's opposite to our orbital angular momentum, then we get this expression, which is about 5.8 m. If we consider the Schwarzschild case, we just get 4 m. So this is, you know, in between the this is smaller than the smallest radius where you can have a stable circular orbit in Schwarzschild, which is at 6 m, but it's inside the, it's outside the light ring, or where you would have these unstable circular orbits. And then for the extremal case, as almost all these values are, that's just at m. And so one other thing we can check is, when is it possible to have a marginally bound orbit that comes in and has a turning point inside the ergosphere of a black hole? So that means when is this less than 2 m, which is the radius of an ergosphere in the equator. So that actually gives us that our dimensionless spin satisfies this, or that it's about that it's greater than about 0.9, so somewhat close to extremal, but not crazy high. So for a high enough spin, you do have these marginally bound orbits that have turning points inside the ergosphere. So we're going to use that fact for the next part and talk about how you can actually you can use the fact that a black hole has an ergosphere to extract energy from it. Before I go into that, are there any questions about this? Okay, so So I'm going to describe what's known as the particle Penrose process. And then after that, we'll talk about a more general class of Penrose processes. So let's consider the forward momentum of some particle with rest mass m. So its forward momentum is p, rest mass m, forward velocity u. And if we want to, if we ask what if we have some other observer with forward velocity na, then the energy that that observer will see for this particle with velocity pa is just what we get by contracting these two vectors. And this has to always be positive, you know, as long as this is future pointing time-like. So with this definition of the energy of the particle, that should always be positive. But this energy is not actually the conserved energy, right? So the conserved energy is defined in terms of the our killing vector associated with our stationary spacetime. And as we discussed before, you know, at large distances, this is just a future pointing time-like vector. But inside the Urger region, this actually becomes a space-like vector. So it doesn't actually correspond to, you know, the forward velocity of any observer like we considered here. And so what that means is that with this definition, this energy can actually become negative inside the black hole's Urger region. So a particle that has negative energy with respect to the killing vector can actually escape the Urger region, you know, along an geodesic. But we can sort of try to use this fact to set up a process where we can extract rotational energy from the black hole. So the idea is the following. So, you know, let's imagine that you're in your spaceship, and after a long space voyage, you're running out of fuel. Luckily, you see a rotating black hole, so you decide to go close to that black hole and try to refuel that way. So the idea is we have a black hole. We have the Urger region here. You have your spaceship come in, enter the Urger region of the black hole. And then at some point, you're near the black hole and you have forward velocity, let's call it PA. And so that's, and then you imagine inside the Urger region, you're going to split into two. So you're going to imagine you take all your garbage, all your recycling, all those beer cans you meant to take to the beer store but never did, and you're just going to throw them into the black hole. So we're going to call that PR for recycling, and then your spaceship is going to go back out of the Urger region and continue on its space voyage with some forward momentum, which I'm going to call PS. So we're going to imagine that we conserve energy and momentum so that PA equals PS plus PR. And that escapes, and that falls into the black hole. All right, so what we want to do is that we want to arrange for this energy associated with all our recycling, which is just given by this usual definition here. We want to arrange for that to be negative. And that means that by conservation of energy, which is just one component of this expression, that the energy of our escaping spaceship, which will be our incoming energy minus this ER, will actually be greater than our original energy. So that's the idea. You know, it's a nice story of black hole recycling. But now we're going to actually work through a specific case using these marginally bound parabolic orbits, both to show that this actually can choose numbers where this happens and to calculate the efficiency of this process for an example. So any questions so far? Yeah?
Is there a maximal orbit in which you can throw the garbage into the black hole so you gain the maximum momentum? Or is there a, is there a constraint?
I guess in general the answer is yes. So we'll work through that, at least for this particular case of parabolic orbits. We'll work through how it depends on basically where you take the turning point and how deep into the ergo region it is.
Oops.
But in general, kind of orbits that get closer to the horizon and then turn around are more efficient. And, in the marginal case would be you just hit the edge of the ergo region and then you can't really gain energy and then go out. Okay, so just to make our calculation simpler, we're gonna take the initial mass up there to be one. In which case, the four velocity of our incoming spaceship just takes the following form. And so here I'm also imagining, we're sticking to equatorial orbits, but I'm also imagining that this process of throwing out all your recycling is happening at a turning point, where the radial velocity is instantaneously zero, which will sort of make things easier, but it's also sort of the way to sort of have a most efficient process. And here this omega is just d phi d tau over d phi dt. So it's like the, So it's just like the coordinate azimuthal velocity. Right, so using just the normalization condition that we set m to 1 and UA contracted at Seltzer be minus 1, and plugging in these components, we get the following. Call that equation star because we're going to use it later. And now, using the fact that we're on a parabolic orbit, we can solve for d tau dt. Double star. So if we combine these two equations and then basically collect terms in omega, we get the following. All right, so basically we just have a quadratic that we can solve for omega once we determine the radius where our turning point is, and then we just evaluate these metric components for Kerr. Right, and so now we want to turn to the four momentum of our escaping spaceship and our recycling. So we can write those in the following way. So again, this is just a normalization constant, which I've used to set this to 1. And then these are, again, free parameters that we'll solve for. And you know, in general, I could have also given some radial velocity to this one as long as I have the opposite one for this one. But that will actually just reduce the efficiency of our process, so we'll set it to 0 for now. All right, so you know, conservation of energy momentum gives us the following. These should add up. And we can basically, yeah, so this is several equations that we can solve for. Can you see if I write here? Or is that? No? Okay. So the T component of this gives us the following. And then the phi component of the energy momentum conservation. Gives us this, and we can just use the first one to eliminate CS or CR from the second one, and then solve for CS. Okay, and now we're ready to calculate the energy that the spaceship escapes with. So, and then we can use this expression, eliminate that here, and we get the following. And, you know, given this amount of energy of our escaping spaceship, we can calculate an efficiency rate, which is just going to be how much energy, the proportion of energy that we escape with, or the difference in energy from what we put in to what we get out divided by what we put in. Right. And you know, with our conventions, this is just 1. Yeah, so all we have to do now is basically choose the the radius we're getting this turning point, and figure out what values we want for omega r and omega s. So to sort of see the allowed values of omega r and omega s, we can consider this equation I have here, where it has star double star implies this. So basically, this is just the normalization condition for the vector p to be future time-like, right? And if you look at equation star there, and we just look at the part in parentheses, we can consider the values of omega where that would equal zero. So those basically determine the values where our velocity approaches the speed of light, because omega is so large. So if we want to write sort of the, we can kind of think of it as there's going to be a maximum value of omega plus and a minimum value of omega minus that are going to determine the null cone, or that velocity. If I took those values, the velocity would actually be null. And we want to choose omega r and omega s in between those. And this plus and minus are just, you know, the roots of that equation. So it actually turns out that the maximum efficiency actually occurs when, you know, in the limit that you let omega r go as close to omega minus as possible, and let omega s go as close to omega plus as possible. So your sort of stuff is falling in almost at the speed of light in the black hole, and you're escaping in the opposite direction with maximum velocity. It's also going to turn out that, not surprisingly, you get the maximum efficiency for an extremal black hole. So let's consider those conditions. So the black hole is extremal. Move it. This go to omega plus, and we let omega r go to omega minus. And then basically, plug those values into these expressions, we can evaluate our efficiency. First of all, if we consider the sort of different radii going from the horizon of the black hole to the edge of the ergosphere, which is at 2m, and then plot these different angular frequencies, basically in units of mega h, which again, for, does anyone remember what that is for an extremal black hole? Okay, it's a 1 over 2m. Basically it's get something like the following. So this would be omega plus, this would be omega minus, and this would be omega, which would just be the angular velocity at the turning point of this incoming marginally bound orbit. And they all sort of meet at the horizon. And then we can calculate the efficiency for these different values. And, you know, as expected, this efficiency has to vanish if we just touch the edge of the ergosphere, and then actually goes up and reaches a maximum value of about 20%. I think the exact number is square root of 2 minus 1 over 2. Yeah, and so that's the maximum efficiency for this particular case. When you have your turning point right next to the horizon of extremal black hole, and you let these opposite velocities approach the speed of light. So, the obvious question is, where did this energy come from? How do we get extra energy? So to help make that more clear, let's recall this vector chi A that I wrote down last time in class, that's written as a linear combination of the Killing vectors. So remember, this is a Killing vector that's time-like for r greater than r plus outside the horizon, and then it becomes null on the horizon. And the black hole horizon is technically the Killing horizon of this vector. And what that means is that that if we consider the forward momentum of any particle, that this should be positive, right? Should be negative. Because this is a future point in time, like, and then as you approach the horizon, it becomes null. So if we just plug in this definition and write it in terms of the conserved quantities, and here I'm going to write a delta just so we can think of a small particle making a perturbation to the black hole. We get that and so for a Penrose process, we're actually taking this to be negative, right? And so that means that this angular momentum that it carries is negative as well. So in fact, we're throwing some particle in that has opposite angular momentum to the black hole is actually going to spin it down a little bit. So that kind of tells us where this energy is coming from. We're actually spinning down the black hole, reducing its rotational energy, and that's how we're actually able to gain some energy in this Penrose process. So any questions about that? So this relation here is actually a special case of the black hole area theorem, which is something that was proved by Stephen Hawking in 1971. And so this states that if you look at the area of the event horizon of a black hole, that this should never decrease, it can only increase. And that's under two assumptions. So if I write delta ABH for the change in the area of the black hole, this should be greater than or equal to 0, assuming one cosmic censorship. So that's this idea that you, in GR, you don't have singularities where curvature blows up that are not hidden behind the horizon, and also assuming the null energy condition. So I briefly mentioned that the first day of class, which would be a sort of mild condition on the kinds of matter you have being having positive energy in some sense. So We'll discuss the black hole area theorem, and that's going to bring us to the general issue of black hole thermodynamics. Okay, so let's begin just by calculating what the area of a Kerr black hole is. So to do that, we just want to take the induced, the determinant of the induced metric on the black hole horizon. Oops. And integrate that over theta and phi. And we get 4 pi r plus squared plus a squared. And if we just plug in the expression for r plus, we can also write it the following way in terms of the mass and angular momentum. So not to confuse you too much, but now I'm using J for the angular momentum of the black hole, not the particle. All right, so now what we want to do is look at what happens when we consider our black hole to have a small change in its mass and its angular momentum, and see how that changes the area of the black hole. So basically, we'll vary this expression with respect to those two quantities. So that's the term corresponding to a change in the mass of the black hole. And then that's the one corresponding to a change in angular momentum. And if we stare at this expression for a second, we can realize that this actually is just equal to 2r plus over a bar, which, as you recall, is 1 over what? It's a frequency. Anyone? Omega. Yeah, this is just omega h. Yeah, so the final expression here can rewrite this in a slightly different way in terms of the dimensionless spin. So here you see we can basically get the same condition as before, where, you know, since the area theorem says that this quantity should be greater than or equal to 0, this change in the black hole's area, that means that we want this quantity here to be greater than this quantity. So it's right, the same one there. All right, any questions about that? So we can, since we're considering cases where the black hole mass can, or let's say it another way. So since the area of the black hole shouldn't decrease, we can define a mass that shouldn't decrease as well, just in terms of the area. So that's the so-called irreducible mass of the black hole, which is just defined to be the area of the black hole divided by 16 pi. So for a non-spinning black hole, that'll just give us the usual mass. And we can check, just get 4 pi r plus squared. And then r plus is 2m. But if on the other hand we consider an extremal black hole, then in that case we actually get that the irreducible mass is going to be the black hole mass divided by the square root of 2. So what that means is that there's actually a lot of energy that is associated with the rotational energy of the black hole, and that, you know, in principle, we could extract without decreasing the area of the black hole. So for this extremal case, you know, it's about 30% of the black hole's mass. And of course, in astrophysical terms, that's quite a lot of energy, right? So if we had a black hole, you know, with mass comparable to the sun or something, I think that would correspond to something like 10 to the 47 joules. So that's one of the reasons we think black holes might power some of the most energetic outbursts of electromagnetic radiation. Any questions so far? So this area increase law actually might remind you of a law in thermodynamics. In which law would that be that tells you something has to increase and can't decrease?
Second law.
That's the second law, yeah. So in thermodynamics, so this is basically the black hole version of the second law. And in this case, the area of the black hole actually takes the role of entropy. In fact, Bekenstein and Hawking rather famously taught us that the entropy of a black hole is actually just the area to a factor of 4 over h bar, but you sort of need quantum mechanics to get this extra normalization factor. But you might ask, are there ways in which we can find analogies between the laws of black hole mechanics and other laws governing or the other laws of thermodynamics? So we begin by discussing the zeroth law of thermodynamics. So that states that, you know, if you have an object in thermal equilibrium, its temperature should be constant. So in order to define the equivalent for black holes, we're going to have to introduce what's called the surface gravity of a horizon. So to do that, we're going to use this vector chi again. So you recall that at the horizon, chi is null. And what that means is that the gradient of chi contracted with itself should be normal to the horizon, right? But since chi itself is also normal to the horizon, that means we should be able to write this in the following way. As proportional to chi, and this proportionality factor I'm calling kappa, so one can so we'll maybe justify why this is called the surface gravity in a second, but if you work out the expression for this for a Kerr black hole, you get the following expression. And to derive this, it's helpful to use this alternative expression, or sort of explicit expression for kappa, which I'm not going to derive in class. So this is where this is evaluated at the horizon. So this expression, you can derive from this, and then also basically using the fact that chi is a killing vector, as well as and it's normal to the horizon. That's done in chapter 8 of Wald. But anyway, if you take this expression and plug it in for Kerr, you get this. And you can see that, in fact, you do get an expression that's constant for any value of phi or theta on the horizon. So that kind of gives us our zeroth law. And here we just evaluate it for a Kerr black hole, but in fact, you can show that it's true in general on a stationary black hole. Just to briefly remind ourselves why we call this the surface gravity, let's just consider Schwarzschild black hole, in which case this just reduces to 1/4m. So if we consider a static observer with some four velocity ua in Schwarzschild, you can write that as the following. So it's just the, well, in this case now, Killing vector associated with being static and some normalization constant. So it just has a time component. Then you can consider this factor here, which I called 1 over v, to be sort of the redshift factor. So you know, that's basically, you know, if you emit a photon with some frequency omega, you know, in the rest frame of this observer, when it goes out to infinity, it'll be redshifted by this factor. And so you can also think of this as sort of as you approach the, so we're going to basically be interested in what's the acceleration on this ecstatic observer as we approach the black hole horizon. And that's going to be our definition of surface gravity. So the observer just sitting there with that four velocity is not falling to a geodesic. You have to exert some acceleration on it. And we can calculate that using this expression. This component is just going to be 0. And then we get this one Christoffel symbol. And then just by normalization, we know this should be minus 1. And then if we just evaluate that Christoffel symbol, we get there's only one non-zero component, and that's when this A is equal to the radial component. So the magnitude of this acceleration as you approach the black hole horizon, this acceleration is going to go to infinity, which sort of makes sense, you know, because you know once it gets to the horizon, it has to fall into the black hole, no matter how much energy you put on it. So that's going to give us an infinite number, but we can think of sort of the redshifted acceleration, which would kind of be, I guess one way to imagine is if you attach some, thin wire to some particle, and then you exert some force very far away, and try to hold it at the black hole horizon. What that would be. So in this case, we bunch of the math and just get m over r squared. And then if we evaluate this at the horizon of our Schwarzschild black hole, we just get 1 over 4m. So, which is the surface gravity. So this is kind of this sort of redshifted acceleration is the same as the surface gravity of the black hole. So you can't sort of apply exactly the same reasoning for a spinning black hole, but this general definition that I wrote down applies for both the spinning and the Schwarzschild case. Of course, the reason is you can't have a static observer at the horizon of a curved black hole, as we argued before. Okay, any questions about that? So that was the zeroth law. We did the second law. The first law, we actually already kind of did the first law as well. When we wrote down this expression here, but now I can write it in a slightly more suggestive way. Of course, the thermodynamic expression we want to compare this with is a sort of conservation of energy. Energy, black hole mass. We can see that we can kind of think of the surface gravity K as our analog of temperature. And then, of course, we already said that the area is the same as the entropy. And this angular momentum here is taking the role of, change in volume. And I guess that would be sort of a pressure. And then finally, sometimes people also mention a third law of black hole thermodynamics, which would basically be that, that even in any idealized process, you shouldn't be able to reduce the surface gravity to zero, which from our expression for the surface gravity, you can see would correspond to having an extreme old black hole. In the last year or two, mathematicians have been busy kind of coming up with counterexamples of ways to do this. But it is sort of true that black holes resist being spun up, sort of at least beyond extremality. As we discussed before, that kind of is something that's sometimes associated with violations of cosmic censorship. So again, your first problem set, you'll work out a couple of examples of why trying to overspin a black hole is hard. But yeah, this third law is maybe a little bit dubious in the black hole case. Yeah, so I think that's a good place to end, and I'll take any questions. No class on Monday. On Tuesday, we'll talk about more general versions of this Penrose process for liberating energy from black hole.